This is a very big room, and I'd encourage you to come in a little bit closer so we don't feel too lonely up here. Okay? For those of you who aren't quite sure where you are, this is session room one. I think most people will know that by now. And we're having a session here on Universal ARV Scale-Up, delivering the second wave. I'll just introduce myself to you. I am one of the co-chairs, and at the moment my fellow co-chair has not yet turned up, but when she does, we will allow her to introduce herself. My name's Charlie Jilks. I'm from the World Health Organization, where I'm in charge of HIV treatment and care. I will introduce each of the speakers as they come up, and they're actually sitting in order of how they will be speaking. But before we start off, I'd like to recognize Ian Weller, who's sitting in the front row here, a person who's known to many of us, because he's the one who has helped put this session together. So I'd like to thank Ian for that. Thank you. Okay, well, without further ado, it's my enormous pleasure to introduce a very old friend and colleague, Peter. I've got a pretty dry biography of Peter, which points out some of his achievements and some of his attributes. I think most people know him as the director of the Joint Clinical Research Center in Kampala, and for the work he's done over the many years, being one of the first sites and individuals in Africa to scale up antiretroviral treatment. Peter is actually a pediatrician, and he's a superb linguist as well, something he's not put down on his bio. He's also a Sunderland football supporter, for those of you who know anything about football. Okay, Peter, I have the pleasure of introducing you. What we intend to do in this session is to allow the speakers 15 to 20 minutes to discuss their perspective on these issues, looking forward to the second wave of ART scale-up. And then we'll have 5 minutes or so specific questions and clarification points on that individual speaker. And then I hope that we will be able to have at the end some general discussions to go over and think about some of the general points that have been made that are common to the three speakers. Okay, thank you, Peter.
Thank you. Thank you, Charlie, for a very generous introduction. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for coming to this session. I bring you greetings from Uganda, and I'm going to talk about the Ugandan situation. It would be very presumptuous of me to talk like I am a Minister of Health official, but I'll talk from the perspective of the organization that I work for. That is the Joint Clinical Research Center. This organization is one of the many that are involved in the antiretroviral therapy program in Uganda. The Minister of Health is very much on the helm, controlling all activities, and the partners are very many, and many of them doing a really wonderful job. My organization, the Joint Clinical Research Center, was founded at the time of greatest crisis in Uganda. It was a country with the highest incidence and prevalence of HIV/AIDS way back in 1991, and this was a crisis measure which brought the Minister of Health, the University, and Minister of Defense to pool their resources and to address the national crisis, having the Minister of Health in the leadership. My organization got a chance to be one of the biggest PEPFAR grantee, and in fact we are the biggest PEPFAR grantee in Uganda, and our job was to scale up antiretroviral therapy, and we have been doing it for the last 5 years. So today I'd like to share with you about some of our activities very briefly, so that you can begin to see how we stand in Uganda. Our approach is not very much different from many other countries' approaches. We have used a series of approaches divided in two sections. Like everybody, at the beginning we had a devastating emergency in our midst. The death toll was very high, and the catastrophe was its height in Africa when we got a chance to start treating HIV/AIDS. We acted like it was an emergency, and that was the appropriate thing to do. And now, in the second phase, we are addressing the question of sustainability. HIV/AIDS is still with us and is going to be with us for a long time. So initially, as I will demonstrate, we used the emergency measures. Infrastructure was always a constraint, and we did low-cost renovations and some improvisations, as I will demonstrate. One of the tools that we used in Uganda, particularly by my organization, which innovated it, was a robust community mobilization program, whereby it was not us that opened the centers for treatment of HIV, it was rather the communities that were empowered to do the opening and leadership in getting them initiated. We thought this was a best practice for introducing antiretroviral therapy to the community, and it has worked most wonderfully. We think it has helped us in breaking stigma and in promoting community ownership of the program. And above all, these occasions have been occasions for information, education, and communication to the public. And feedbacks that we get from areas where we have opened numerous centers are extremely positive. Of course, in developing countries, one of the biggest questions that we face is going to a place and finding absolutely no infrastructure, and yet people have got a need for antiretroviral therapy. And one such place was Mubende, and this method, we have used it all over and over again, and it has helped us in scaling up antiretroviral therapy in our country. In such a situation, whether there is no infrastructure or not, we still start the program. All we do is to come with our tent, pitch it, and then it's functional almost instantaneously, and we start providing the treatment. It's not true that in Africa we are satisfied with these kind of infrastructures, but it is not excusable to refuse people treatment because the infrastructure does not exist. What you need to do is to start giving care and treatment while you are doing what we did. And this place, this is now how it looks like in Mubende. We have grumbled, like many other countries, with the question of human resource. There is critical shortage of skilled human resource in Uganda, particularly to undertake advanced laboratory work and even other services like counseling and adherence work. And what we've done is to try and recruit as many staff as we could find, but these are not always available. And then another challenge is getting people to work in remote areas. And the way we have been working on this, as we shall demonstrate, is to try and make working in such conditions worthwhile for the staff. The training of our people has been a very important tool to get the programs going. It would not be possible to first get people trained and then start the programs. What we did, we started and continued to train as we went ahead, and we used all kinds of methods of training while we worked. And many other countries that have come to be associated with have been doing exactly the same thing. We have trained people in palliative care, in TB treatment, in the laboratory testing, including advanced tests like viral load and CD4, and we have included also training of lay people, including community volunteers, to help medical care providers provide the extensive services that is necessary for countrywide antiretroviral therapy. We have also had the generous support of some experts inside and outside our country. So, what have we achieved and where are we at the moment as an organization, Joint Clinical Research Center? This is the kind of graph that has been replicated in virtually all sub-Saharan Africa, and ours has been no exception. As our organization alone, we have been able to start close to 70,000 people on antiretroviral therapy, and we follow on a continuous basis in excess of 30,000 people, doing complete monitoring that includes CD4 and viral loads whenever required. And we have achieved stations in all parts of the country, currently 50 of them, main stations, and we have got 25 outreaches. These outreaches specifically target hard-to-reach areas and underserved communities. In addition, we have established one center of excellence in each region of the country. Each color represents where each center of excellence serves. They serve on referral basis tests like CD4s, viral load, and for viral load, PCR, we also do infant diagnosis. And these are some of the pictures of some simple but highly practical structures that we have set up in each region of the country that are coordinated in Kampala at the main headquarters and are serving in various capacities. As I have said, these centers are providing CD4 and viral load, which are available in each region. They don't have to come to Kampala, the capital. Secondly, we are able to do infant diagnosis, DNA, PCR, in each of those regional centers of excellence. And we have these validated nationally and internationally. And we have in Kampala HIV and TB resistance facilities so that where necessary, these are referred to our central laboratories. Of course, those are not what defines a successful national program. Other aspects are equally important. I consider adherence to be a vital program for treatment success. And we have established a countrywide adherence network coordinated in Kampala, having a manager in each region, and each center has got an adherence officer who work closely with the community, and we have developed a training syllabus for community to support adherence program in our centers. We also have had another program called Treat for Life, which we launched and rolled out. This is an advocacy program, a program that mobilizes our population to come for treatment at the treatment centers, provides information, and is also largely run by a volunteer force. And we have produced materials in appropriate languages for the community to use in their setups. Perhaps of particular importance has been the establishment of a working logistics systems. In all the 75 places where we work, we don't run out of drugs, we don't run out of laboratory reagents, and we have our equipment maintained properly and regularly. This is an example which we want to be adopted nationally so that we have got a robust national program that never runs short of these essential items. You can have an excellent adherence program. You can have whatever you like, but it will not work if drugs are not delivered to the people in a timely manner, if laboratory reagents are not delivered in good condition. And you can put there as many equipment as you like, but if they are not serviced regularly, they just gather dust. So these are some of the areas where we have been concentrating our energies to work and make sure that we have got a program that can give a service that can be relied upon. In addition, we have support supervision so that people keep strengthening each other. We get centers evaluating others to make sure that they strengthen each other and keep bringing up the standards. So we come to the second wave. PEPFAR was approved. We have been dealing with an emergency. When does the emergency end? So in the second theme in my program, and I believe my country, is to plan to move from crisis management to quality, sustainable, and integrated program into a national health system. Certainly, without improvement in general or public health sector, the services that have been established specifically for HIV/AIDS are ultimately futile and cannot be sustained. So it is imperative that we have a theme in our second wave of making sure that we strengthen our national health systems. How do we do it? I think what needs to be done is very well understood by most of us. Our public sector facilities need to be rehabilitated, and the sectors, rather the facilities that have been set up for HIV/AIDS through PEPFAR, through global funds, need to be shared. Because if you are doing microbiology testing for HIV/AIDS, for instance, to diagnose opportunistic infections, there is absolutely no reason why such facilities would not be availed to other patients who may not be HIV infected but need care. Most of those are relatives of the HIV-infected patients. It is the same community, it is the same family, and therefore we need to share out these facilities. So we need also to have new structures put in at all levels. This includes laboratories. In Uganda, we plan to have CD4 and viral load done at every regional hospitals and high-volume district hospitals. We plan to establish basic laboratory services at health centers to include HIV testing, TB, and malaria diagnosis. We can't achieve all of this unless we address manpower needs. And in the second wave, we intend to do as much as possible, and we need donor support and program support to make sure that the public sector workers, because these are neglected and yet they are critical for national health service and also for HIV service, that these people are supported. If we don't support them, in Uganda, we have noticed a very worrying trend of internal brain drain. We have got all kinds of programs, donor programs, which are doing a good job, but they take healthcare providers from other programs, and you get confusion. You get internal brain drain, and you also get external brain drain. We cannot have a law, like some African countries, we are trying to inform one of the advanced countries, that could you please refuse to have Africans coming to your country? Well, you can't have it that way, because people will find ways of beating that system. The best system is to improve work conditions in our countries so that work there becomes attractive. We can negotiate other measures like compensation, because our workers who go abroad do contribute something to those developed nations, and we could do that as well. But the best we need to do is to make sure that we improve our work conditions so that we can retain our workers. We need strengthened training, including community volunteers and lay providers, to support adherence and undertake other low-tech but high-demand services. We need also, as I have said, to give special incentives to healthcare providers to work in rural areas. There are certain rural areas, the incentives most care providers need are not very difficult to provide, and we can do that, and that would be absolutely essential in the next wave. So we need to take away clauses from Global Fund and PEPFAR which say we cannot support workers in the public sector. Without supporting them, we can't succeed. We also need to establish a robust logistics system for drugs and laboratory services to all levels. And we need to aim at quality and sustainable services, and these will depend on good adherence, counseling, and strengthening of integrated services for better outcome, not only for HIV, but for TB as well. So, in conclusion, the next wave for my country must harness the available HIV expertise, logistics, and facilities to strengthen the existing health system for eventual integration. Integration would be the key for the future. And this would be integration into an improved national general delivery of healthcare services. With continued support, my country, Uganda, I have absolutely no doubt we are ready for universal ART access. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, thank you very much, Peter, for that inspiring tour de force of how describing how you've built up, you and your colleagues, with immense support from PEPFAR and other partners, a very impressive ART service, and for the reflections that you've made on what is going to need to sustain that as we move towards universal access. I'm going to call on people if they would like to ask Peter for comments or make or questions or make some comments in response to his excellent presentation to come to find a microphone. Please introduce yourself first and then ask the question, and try and be succinct, because I can see already there are several people who want to make a contribution.
Yes. My name is Françoise Jenneskens from the Royal Tropical Institute in Amsterdam. Thank you very much for your interesting presentation. And I would be interested to get a little bit a better idea of which exact strategies you use to improve working conditions of the healthcare workers, and especially those ones in the public sector. And if there would be a disparity between the health workers working in the PEPFAR program versus the ones working in the health in the public sector.
I think that's precisely the point. There is a discrepancy between PEPFAR programs. They are better paid, they are better facilitated, and therefore we are getting a movement of people from the public sector to the better paid PEPFAR and Global Fund supported jobs. This is unacceptable. The way to go about it is to get a budget of PEPFAR not to entirely pay for the salaries of those in public sectors, but improve condition within their workplaces. It is already happening in my program. I didn't have time to go into that. And also to sort of top up some of their allowances while they give some of these services. And then, of course, we don't expect our country to have all salaries of public sector workers paid by donors. We need our countries to start dedicating more budget to healthcare providers, which can be supplemented by donors, and together we may be able to improve the health sector conditions.
Microphone on the right, please introduce yourself.
Thank you. My name is Henry Nagai. I work for Family Health International in Ghana. Peter, you mentioned the fact that you encourage sharing of facilities. I would like to know whether you engage the private sector in the sharing of these facilities and how you go about that, if you do so.
Yeah, sharing of facilities is fairly straightforward. And we have got some examples to demonstrate. You set up laboratories like these centers of excellence. In the second wave, these kind of laboratories will be in the district and in regional hospitals. Where they are, they should not be specific and exclusively for HIV/AIDS, because without additional cost, the same kind of equipment could provide services for other clinical care providers. And incidentally, this is one of the ways of improving facilities for healthcare providers. If a clinician can have a microbiological diagnosis, if a surgeon can have electrolytes, if a woman going to deliver can have HB done quickly, a good hemogram done quickly, all of these are incentives and conditions that will improve general health care. And it doesn't really need to do much. It is a deliberate program of making sure that we utilize and share out these facilities that we develop.
Thank you. We have four more people who want to ask questions. If they can try and keep the questions quick and brief, then Peter can answer them briefly. And try and speak clearly. We're now competing with the rain on the roof. Thank you.
I'm Dr. Rivari from India. I have two quick questions from you. I compliment you for your insight into what the second wave is going to be. But you said your CD4 and viral load facilities are available only at regional laboratories. How do the patients who are in the periphery, how do they access these testing facilities? Number one. And number two was about the second line drugs. Since we are talking of the second wave, what is the plan for rollout of second line drugs?
Yes, the services that have been established are accessible to anybody, any patient. They don't need to be PEPFAR-specific patients. They can be Minister of Health. They can be public sector. That is, patients attending private clinics. They are all welcome to access these facilities that have been established. What was the second bit? And the second line drugs, we are providing them as well. Fortunately, most of our patients are naive over the last 5 years. The second line drugs are going to be very, very expensive. We have to have a robust program of adherence so that we minimize the need for second line. They are much more expensive. And when first line drugs are used very, very well, we have got fewer people progressing to need second line. Currently, fortunately, we have enough drugs for our patients who need second line drugs.
I'm afraid we have to move on to the next speaker now. Thank you. Maybe we'll have time for general discussion if you could keep your questions.
Thank you. Thanks very
much
for
your
questions.
Thank you very
much,
Peter. Can I just check that people in the hall can hear what the speaker is saying? We're finding it quite difficult hearing from the microphones from the floor, but are you able to hear us clearly in competition with the rain? Yes? Okay, well, we'll try and continue and hope it stops raining. It's my pleasure now to introduce Sam Thiry, who's another old friend and colleague, to give a presentation from Malawi. Sam's a Malawian clinician with a special interest in care and operations research, and he works, and he's been working for 7 years in the Department of Medicine at Kamuzu Central Hospital, KCH, in Lilongwe. He's recently earned his PhD in clinical epidemiology at the London School earlier this year, and he's a founding member and executive director of the Lighthouse Trust. And I've had the pleasure of watching his career grow as the Lighthouse Trust has grown to be one of the largest, if not the largest, ART providers in Malawi. So it's a great pleasure to introduce Sam and ask him to give his paper. Thank you, Sam.
Thank you. It's really a great honor to be in this session, and good afternoon. One thing which I should mention that it is a great honor is that to have Charlie to chair this session. As he already mentioned, that has seen me growing and is one of the role models, including Peter. So I think presenting after Peter is just, a good also flow within the presentation. I'll be presenting on the national scale-up of Malawi, looking at mainly the achievements, and then through the achievements, looking at what the lessons have been learned, then what are the challenges which have to be looked at as we are looking into the second wave. Now, this presentation is actually available because of the great leadership of the HIV/AIDS unit within the Ministry of Health, and working together with the partnership within the whole country of Malawi in order to make sure that the national scale-up is working on in a great success. Now, Malawi decided to look at the treatment of ART, mainly looking at the WHO clinical criteria. Malawi started to provide antiretroviral therapy in 2004 free with support from the Global Fund. Now, in 2003, there were only 4,000 patients who were started on ART. And as of December 2007, over 150,000 were started on ART and over 100,000 are alive on treatment. So this is, it was seen as an ambitious scale-up plan, and everybody was looking on what the achievements are going to be, because Malawi is considered as one of the countries, and it is the country which has a lot of crisis in terms of human resource. When the national scale-up program was designed, targets were set in terms of how many people should be started on ART each year. And from 2005 to 2007, what we've seen is that Malawi has been surpassing its targets. As we can see, that in 2007, the target was surpassed by over 30,000 patients. So this was quite a successful understanding for the people to say that we'll be able to deliver the program even with a lot of challenges. Now, as I mentioned already, to look at the program, it is public sector along with this, the private sector. And when we have looked at this, we've looked at whereby in 2006, in terms of patients alive on treatment, we just missed the target by only 20 patients. But when we look at 2007, June and December, we actually surpassed our target in terms of the number of patients alive and on treatment. This was also another achievement. One of the things which we have to look at when we are looking at delivering ART is that in terms of the challenges of the stockouts of antiretroviral therapy, and also to look at drugs for opportunistic infections. When the program was set, as of December 2007, no facility had a stockout of the first-line regimen, looking at the initiation and also the continuation. One of the things which we saw, 12 facilities had a complete stock out of cotrimoxazole prophylactic therapy, CPT, vincristine and morphine, which are drugs to be used for the opportunistic infections, for example, KS, and also for the prophylaxis for opportunistic infections. The target was about 40, but there were about 12 facilities which had a complete stock. However, when we looked at facilities providing CPT as a package, the target was about 20, but as of that time, 113 facilities were providing. And this I'm going to talk about later on when you look at challenges. The new initiatives which have been put forward after learning from the first wave was that all patients, looking at the lessons which have been learned internationally and also locally, was that we were giving D4T 30 and 40, but then it was decided that we should be able to provide D4T 30, Stavidin 30, for all the patients, regardless of their weight, because there's actually less toxicity with the same efficacy, and also as a program, it is easier for focusing the procurement and also looking at the expense. One other thing we've been discussing, task shifting, is that instead of only physicians to start treatment on ART, we have now nurses who are initiating ART on top of the following up of the visits as they were doing starting from the program. And in order to monitor the program quite well, it was actually put forward to make sure that the public and private sector monitoring and evaluation is aligned so that we should be able to have a good grasp of the successful program within the country. But as we're talking that our patients now ever started over 150,000, the question is, how do we manage these patients in sites whereby you have over 5,000, over 8,000, and using the paper record system? So one other new initiative is to look at the electronic data system, which was piloted in the northern and the central region, to make sure that all the high burden sites should be able to use electronic data system in the monitoring. Now, I'll just briefly look at the national data, looking in the public sector in terms of the number of patients and also the outcomes. In terms of access, as of 2007, December, in the public sector, over 140,000 were started, and great proportion of them, 61% were women, and about 8% were children. In terms of, as I mentioned already, that initiation of ART was based on clinical criteria, 65% of the patients were in stage 3, and one thing which I need to mention over here is that we had about few patients who had started as a clinical criteria being as TB, because 70% of TB patients in Malawi are HIV positive, and TB is an eligibility for ART initiation. And having 14% being started because they are on TB treatment is a small proportion. And also in terms of the number of patients started on ART amongst the PMTCT moms. So this is another area which I'll address later on when we are looking about the future. In terms of survival, we looked at number of patients who are alive and on treatment, and we still had about two-thirds of the patients being alive and on treatment. And you can see that We have about 12% mortality and a default rate of 10%. And those who have stopped treatment were less than 1%. And then there are people who transfer from one center to the other were around 10%. Now, let me just look at the patients, the 12% who died. Just similar to other, consistent to other countries, about 65% of the patients had died in the first 3 months. So the mortality is higher in the first 3 months. And this is attributed to the late health-seeking behavior within this within Malawi. And this, as I mentioned already, is consistent with the data which has been presented here and also which has been published. Just quickly to mention that in terms of clinical monitoring, now 96% of the patients are still on first-line regimen. And those who are on second-line are still less than 1%. And this, I should mention, is because we look at the clinical monitoring in order to achieve to ascertain failure or in order to ascertain on who goes on second-line regimen. Now, after looking at that, as you can see that starting from 4,000 patients in 2003 to over 150,000 patients in 2007, now we're looking at what are the challenges which we have experienced throughout this program. Then as I'm looking at the challenges, I'll be able to be looking at also what are the possible solutions which we have looked at. We've already mentioned that there were few patients who were started on ART, and what has happened now in the country, because previously only specialized centers were providing treatment for pediatric for children. So pediatric care was actually realized and recognized to be done only at a specialized center. However, we actually decided to make sure that as a country, we should roll out pediatric care to all sites which are providing ART, so that we should increase the access of care of our children to ART. And one other component is to make sure that the diagnosis should also actually be, we should be able to increase the uptake of care by the early infant diagnosis using PCR in most of the sites. The idea is to fall in line even with the WHO recommendation to make sure that these are put on treatment. One other thing which I mentioned already, a challenge is few pregnant women put on ART. And these are challenges in terms of how they are referred from the antenatal to go to the ART because of being probably different buildings or different sites. So one other solution to that is to make sure that in our effort as we look into the future and currently is to make sure that we improve the linkage between the PMTCT sites, like the antenatal clinic and the ART sites, to make sure that there's a physical linkage, and also in terms of planning, there should be actually a great linkage. And some of these, for example, one of the initiatives is the Martin Proust Center, which is actually a center which the Lighthouse operates in collaboration with the Lilongwe District Health Office. This is actually purposefully built to link up patients from the PMTCT to the ART. Another component as a challenge and as a solution to the PMTCT is to make sure that when you talk about CD4 count, as a priority, would make sure that the pregnant moms would be able to access the CD4 count, because would increase actually the number of patients who would access treatment based on this. From our experience, from the Martin Proust Center, we saw that there was an additional 21% actually of patients who actually were not eligible according to the clinical criteria from the PMTCT, but they were eligible because of the CD4 count. I mentioned already also coming to TB. There's an issue of TB and HIV co-infection. And few patients from the TB are accessing ART. The setup in Malawi is that most of the sites which are providing TB treatment are manned by the people who are in the public health field. So while the ART is managed actually by the patient, by the clinicians and nurses. Now, if you want to make sure that you harness the two, it means that when someone has a TB, when they've been treated for TB, then they should be able to move to the ART clinic, and patients are lost in between. One of the solutions is to make sure that we have all the TB sites and the ART sites as should be aligned to make sure that they are providing the integrated management. And as I mentioned already about the Martin Luther Center, is one of the purposefully built centers in order to link up also TB and ART. And as a country, we are actually making sure that we're discussing, put some efforts to make sure that all sites which are providing TB should also be able to be providing antiretroviral therapy. Moving further, we've already also noted that there's a high error death rate amongst ART patients. And as I mentioned, the reason being because of the health-seeking behavior. One of the things which we had to put in is to make sure that we rolled out the provision of CPT into all ART sites. Because previously, as it was already mentioned in another session, that we have not been doing pre-ART clinics because of the burden of the number of patients to come to the clinic. But we want to make sure that all the patients who are eligible starting from stage 2 should be put on CPT, which is going to actually improve their life. And also, where CD4 count is available, then it should be able to be done, which would actually increase the number of patients to be started on ART. The other component, which is a challenge, is the high numbers of patients who are lost to follow-up. And over 10% being lost to follow-up. Now the question is, how do we make sure that these patients are coming back? And what we have to put in is to put in supportive active default tracing, which will be able to follow up these patients. In some of the studies which have been done in Malawi, we found out that about 50% of the patients who are recorded as lost to follow-up have actually died. And some of them are alive on treatment, but they have moved to another center without a transfer. So when you are able to trace them, we'll be able to ascertain these actually components. And so we should be able as a country to put up support for the default tracing within this program. And as I am moving actually to close, is that skilled human resources are too few in Malawi. And I don't need to emphasize more on that. So the issues of task shifting have been discussed in most sessions within here. And the nurses, as I mentioned already, are able to initiate on top of also this, the follow-up of the patients. And also, one of the things we have done is to make sure that the healthcare workers are treated on ART to make sure that they remain within the system and provide the service. One other thing which I have to mention is that to make sure that there are better conditions within the service to make sure that healthcare workers are retrained within the system. And this is going to be critical for the second wave. And finally, as I'm looking at the number of patients exponentially increasing in all sites, the issue is there are other strategies on top of task shifting which are supposed to be used. One of it is being decentralization, and we have seen a presentation, for example, this afternoon by Choro District in Malawi with MSF to look at how effective it is to go further beyond the specialized centers to go to the health centers. And also to look at the role of the community in terms of how they would be able to assist in treatment adherence. So with actually these challenges and solutions, what I can conclude is that the national scale-up of ART is feasible in a developing country like Malawi. At the same time, it has challenges which are going to be available throughout the delivery. But the partnership of the Ministry of Health with other partners is critical also to make sure that you can actually work out the strategies together in order to make sure that you deliver in the second wave. So, in closing, let me actually thank the head of the HIV unit, Dr. Keita Kamoto, Professor Tori Harris, and Mr. Simon Makombe for providing the leadership in the HIV AIDS department and the Ministry of Health to make sure that this program should be a success. And on top of that, for being open enough to other partners to make sure that they should work together. And funding for the program is from the Global Fund and many development partners. And the recipient of the Global Fund is the National Health Commission, and also, as I said, for the collection of the drugs and collection of data is through with other stakeholders. And I should also thank the Fogarty International Center through UNC for actually bringing me over to Mexico to be able to present several actually presentations. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sam, for a great and inspiring presentation to outline how one of the poorest countries in the world, with one of the most severe epidemics, generalized epidemics, has managed to produce some outstanding results. If people could come to the microphone and introduce themselves, I'm just going to take Chairman's prerogative here and just make one very brief comment. Malawi does have some excellent and unusual data. And one of the points with the 100,000 people, or just under 100,000 people, alive and on ART at the end of 2007 is to note that 2% of those are, when they register for ART, call themselves healthcare workers. So there are 2,000 healthcare workers alive and on ART at the end of 2007 who would either have been too sick and incapacitated to work or already would be dead. So I think that's a very important contribution that ART and treatment services are making to the human resource is in health crisis in many parts of Africa. Okay, so over to Ronnie.
Yeah. Ronnie Zachariah, Médecins Sans Frontières, Brussels. Thanks, Sam, for an excellent presentation. I was just wondering, could you tell us if there are any national plans or strategies to increase the numbers of qualified staff, health staff, to cope with the second wave? Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ronnie. Actually, it's great to see you actually in this session. After a long time without coming to Malawi, there is indeed a plan whereby there's the human resource strategy, which is looking at to retain people who are in the country, and also to actually attract actually more people to go into training, and also to make sure that there should be a program whereby some other people who moved out from the public sector should be able to come back. So there's a clear national human resource strategy which looks at to make sure that we should have a lot of people to come back into the service and deliver the service, including the ART.
Microphone on the right.
Hi, my name is Jahed Islam, International HIV AIDS Alliance, Ukraine. My question is, you have made a very nice presentation, actually very impressive, a scale up. Just to highlight maybe one or two main driver of this success, if you could just point out, which was your main driver of this success, like one or two examples, task shifting or something else, which you consider the main your driver of this success?
Good, that's an excellent question. In terms of the drive of success, to begin with, was that when we decided that we should be able to start the rollout, one, we decided to make it simple. So one first run regimen for all the sites in the country and using the public health approach. And the other one was also to look at the ministry trying to embrace all the partners within the country from the inception of the design of the program throughout to make sure that we should share. For example, like colleagues like MSF, Dignitas, the Lighthouse Conference, and also the other partners within the country. So these are the driving forces of making sure that the success is there.
Yes, thank you so much, Mr. Ferry, and for your wonderful presentation. My name is Bukeni. I am from New York, United States, but originally from the Congo. I used to work in the DRC demobilizing child soldiers, among them girls. In 2004, I demobilized a girl who was 21 years old, and she learned that she was HIV positive in 2006. I paid for her to have the HIV test. She just passed away on June 27, less than 2 months from now. Now, as we're talking about delivering the second wave, that girl died. Since she learned she was HIV positive, she never got any ARV. I tried my best, but I couldn't find any. That was in Eastern DRC. My question, actually I have two questions. The first one is, that is just one example among millions, hundreds of others in Africa and many other countries. So the questions are, do you think we can achieve an universal action, since in some part of the world people are still paying $3 to get HIV test? And the second one, what do you think will be, or will these people who were left out in this first wave, do you think they will be included in the second wave? Thank you.
Thank you. That's an incredible question. It is actually a general question, and actually what I can answer is on the basis of it's great to have Charlie here from WHO and other partners around. But what I can say is that there is always a starting point, and I have lots and lots of stories which I can give before 2000 in Malawi and before 2004 in Malawi, whereby patients had to contribute, or there was not even, the drugs were not even available in the country. So my accurate instinct is that there is always a starting point, and some countries like Malawi and others have started, and it is actually all the donors and partners who are available should be able actually to buy into and work with the governments. Also, governments have to put in their own initiative on what they can contribute in order to deliver the second wave. So from my perspective of Malawi is that there's only a starting point. You could start and move forward as long as there's a government commitment. Then you'll be able to attract other supporters. When you have a successful program, then actually other things will be falling into place, you know, in terms of supporting. So that's, I think, one thing which I can mention of it.
I'm allowed one more question, Dr. Rawari. Nice and short, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Ferry, for an excellent presentation and analysis of data. We have something similar in India, where 190,000 patients have been initiated on ART and 155,000 are continuing. My comment was about the second line regimen. You said less than 1% patients are requiring second line. I think in 4 years rollout, that is an excellent thing, because we have a failure rate of around 2.8%. The question second was about the deaths. You said 65% of deaths are in first 3 months. Have you analyzed it further in terms, what are the reasons? Was it a low baseline CD4 count, late entry, or toxicity, or not treating the intercurrent OIs, because your regimen doesn't have provision for treating tuberculosis? You have not mentioned, you have only one regimen with nevirapine or a iris. What could be the possible reasons for this early death, 65% deaths in 3 months?
Okay. I think what I can say is that, to begin with your first question, is that as I already said, that we actually have a certain failure using our clinical criteria. So of course, because we don't do viral loads, so if we are able, we do clinical criteria and also immunological for only some of the patients who are able to have a CD4 count. So that is another reason. If we are doing like virology, actually this actually could go beyond actually the less than 1%. In terms of your second question, which is looking at what are the causes of death. I can talk about on like a subset of the patients which we look at. We cannot be able to say much on, we haven't analyzed more on what are the main causes. However, the main causes which we have observed, for example, in our Lighthouse perspective, which is one of the largest centers, is that it's really undiagnosed TB is one of the causes. So the undiagnosed opportunistic infections, as these patients are coming in late already, as they're starting, once we are stabilizing them, some of them actually are dying at this time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sam.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, now we move on to our third speaker, who's from the Ukraine, and obviously a very different HIV epidemic. I've not had the pleasure to meet Andriy Klepikov before, so I don't know what football team he supports. He'll tell me later. But Dr. Klepikov is the Executive Director of the International HIV-AIDS Alliance in Ukraine, which is the largest HIV-AIDS-focused organization in the country, and in fact one of the largest in the Eurasian region. He has had a managing portfolio of the two global fund AIDS programs in Ukraine. He's also a chief of party of the five-year project Scale Out National Response to HIV/AIDS through Information and Services, with the delightful acronym of SUNRISE, which is funded by USAID. In the past, he's worked as a senior program manager at International Health Studies in the New School for Social Research in New York, and he currently participates at the Business Education Program International Masters in Practicing Management out of McGill. Okay, thank you.
I would like to thank the organizers for the opportunity to present the progress we made in Ukraine over the last couple of years, and to thank all the colleagues with whom I am working with on this program. That's correct, the situation in Ukraine is quite different from the situation in Malawi and Uganda. At the same time, this is the most problematic situation among all European countries. The prevalence rate is 1.63% among adult population, the highest in the region. Estimated number of HIV positive people is 440,000 people. At the same time, official statistics says a lower figure. It's over 130,000 officially registered HIV cases in Ukraine. In Ukraine, we have a concentrated epidemic fueled by injecting drug use. At the same time, epidemic is slowly getting generalized, but most of the heterosexually attributed infections linked to drug use, so to affiliated with drug users, so it's partners or sexual partners of injecting drug users. If you look on the map of Ukraine, you may see that it's a diverse situation among different regions, but in south and eastern part of Ukraine, this is the most problematic situation. All these problems we are trying to address major with the help of international assistance. Major response is provided through the funding from the Global Fund to fight AIDS, tuberculosis and malaria. Ukraine was awarded two grants with an overall budget over $250 million. We have a very unique situation because initially around one grant was provided to the government, mainly focusing on ARV treatment. At the same time, government failed to implement the program due to the problem in procurement and managing the grant. So at the beginning of 2004, it was a really crisis situation for the country. We nearly faced the situation of losing opportunity to change the situation in the country. And starting from March 2004, NGO, non-governmental organization, HIV-AIDS Alliance, was appointed as a steward of the grant to save the situation. So it was extremely challenging task for us, actually, to pick up the failed grant, failed program from the government. Program focusing on ARV treatment and aimed to change the situation in the country. Today, I am really happy and proud to say that due to the grant funding, we managed in broader partnership to achieve the major scale-up, ARV scale-up in the region. 137. What do you think this figure is about? It is about the patients on ARV by the time we started the grant, by early 2004. With several hundred thousand of ARV, of HIV-infected people, only 137 patients just 4 years ago had access to governmentally funded ARV treatment. Situation is look differently today. So almost, actually over 9,000 people are on ARV today, and mainly with due to the support of the Global Fund grant. So over 63%, you see the red red column, it's a number of patients funded by the Global Fund. We also influence the growing share of the governmentally funded patients through advocacy and lobbying for allocation bigger financial resources. If describe our partnership and approach, as I mentioned, it was extremely challenging task for NGO to manage nationally wide ARV treatment program rollout with no success previous background, so starting from scratch. Partnership was extremely important, so we agreed to partner with the Ukrainian AIDS Center, its major governmental infrastructure for the treatment provision, as well as have an umbrella agreement with the Ministry of Health. And our main partner among NGOs is All Ukrainian Network of People Living with HIV/AIDS. Currently, all 27 regions are enrolled into ARV treatment, and we were basing on detailed assessment of all the regions done in partnership with WHO and other partners, including non-governmental sector. Because we are NGO, so we were strictly following the guidelines and actually helped to adopt WHO guidelines on treatment and diagnostics, VCT, TB diagnostics, and STI guidelines as well. Our model was based on multidisciplinary teams, which includes social worker from NGO, medical doctor, and nurse. As it was mentioned by my colleagues, human resource factor was very important, so we trained with the support of the WHO-established knowledge hub over 450 professionals. From this chart, you may see HIV treatment coverage. It's huge step forward what's made over the last 4 years, from 3% of coverage according to the need to 35% of coverage. 35 is still a low figure, but At the same time, the red column shows the estimated number of patients needed treatment. But you know that it's very important to treat not an estimated person, but the real person. So it's also a challenge to involve bigger numbers of marginalized groups, drug users, into the treatment programs. You may see the major progress made in comparison with 2004-2005. I would like to draw your attention to the percentage of patients still alive after 12 months after the initiation of treatment. So it's 89.9% by now. And percentage of unsupervised discontinuation of treatment is 5.7%, which is which exceeds our target. This diagram I am especially proud of. Epidemic is growing everywhere, almost everywhere. So we almost everywhere see the diagrams going up and up, which means more and more problems. In 2007, there was a turning point in number of HIV, of AIDS cases registered in Ukraine. So this figure dropped from 4,723 patients to 4,573 patients. So it's relatively small figure, 150 patients, but at the same time we save life of these people, and HIV didn't turn into the AIDS for them. At the same time, we see stabilizing of AIDS mortality rate. It's still growing, but we see the slowdown of this growth, which also may be attributed to the ARV treatment, mainly scaled up by the Global Fund support. I would like to say that in some regions where when ARV treatment was initiated earlier and at the appropriate scale, we already see the dropout in mortality rate. So we really hope that this tendency will be nationwide. We're also proud by the changes which are very important for our country. Several of them I would like to list. Setting up implementation standards. It's very important that we are managing the program in appropriate way, because we will be not managing this for ages. Government will and should pick up this commitment in regard to the treatment of all patients. So one example is price reduction. When the grant was suspended, government procured some of the drugs with a price exceeding our price in 27 times. It's huge difference. It's like buying a piece of bread for $100. So it's hardly to imagine this difference. At the same time, year by year, prices are getting normalized. And today, almost there is no big differences between prices government pays and alliance pays for ARV drugs, which is very, very positive tendency and guarantee for further sustainability. Another very important change civil society organization brought is influencing policy environment. Sometimes it's very difficult to change the policy for the government officials. For the NGO, it's more easy to be critical about higher price, about non-transparent mechanisms, about lack of funding from the national sources. So we even managed to reach the presidential level, addressing these issues, and not only addressing, but basically influencing some positive changes. Crucial innovations. The most important is introduction of substitution treatment with buprenorphine and last year with methadone. It's very, very important for the country when, according to the WHO estimation, 60,000 drug users are required this treatment, substitution treatment. Another innovations, IRV treatment in prisons, rapid tests, other things, so important addition to the IRV treatment provision. Ensuring sustainability by strengthening national capacities and systems. As I mentioned, we didn't build a parallel system. We invested all resources, even channeled through NGOs, into the strengthening governmental system for the long-term support. We advocating for the setting appropriate targets for the government for the future five-year national strategy. So key lessons from managing big national scale IRV treatment focused programs that NGOs are able to do this, are able not only to be involved, be in charge of the small part, but basically do it with the government, sharing ownership, jointly sorting out problems and sharing responsibility for future steps. Addressing challenges, they are very important for us. The nearest one is actually handing over all patients treated with the Global Fund grant funding to the government, and it should happen really soon, in from October 2008. So we really aimed to guarantee this, to ensure governmental funding and proper procurement and even logistics in time. Another challenge is decentralization of treatment, especially having in mind so ambitious treatment scale-up plan. It's very important to go beyond the specialized infrastructure of the AIDS centers. We have some good pilots in several regions, particularly in Donetsk, so where treatment is also provided through the system of general medical service provision. So it's very important to do further decentralization of treatment provision and train medical professional, ensure appropriate planning, logistics, and treatment monitoring mechanisms. Another very, very big issue for us is integrating services for patients with HIV, TB, and drug dependency, including establishment of central of special centers for comprehensive service provision for these patients. TB remains one of the biggest, if not the biggest, issue associated with HIV/AIDS in Ukraine, and it's not appropriately addressed yet. Ensuring cost-effective mechanisms for the governmental procurement and adhering to quality standards are very important tasks for us for the next months as well as in a long-term perspective. Eliminating policy barriers for scaling up methadone-based substitution maintenance treatment remains a key task because epidemic is still fueled by injecting drug use, and majority of adult HIV-infected people, almost 70%, are injecting drug users. So access for substitution therapy for majority of them means access to ARV treatment as well. Further plans are very ambitious. In our new five-year strategy, government set very ambitious universal access ARV target as 80,000 patients by the end of 2013. To achieve these very ambitious targets, all the issues listed before should be realized. Otherwise, it will remain unachieved. So, thank you so much, and we will win the battle. No pasaran.
Thank you very much for that equally inspiring presentation outlining the immense challenges that were faced in Ukraine, particularly with the Global Fund, but how that they have been overcome and how you are now looking forward with the lessons of that towards universal access. We have time for a few speakers or comments from the floor if people would like to find a microphone. Please introduce yourself and try and keep the questions short. Thank you. Okay, over here for the first question.
Thank you. My name is Wissal Mustafa from Health Alliance International. Might be confused by the organization, Sudan. I remain a bit skeptic when it comes to countries with lower HIV prevalence. Probably Malawi, I think it was at, 12%, and at Ukraine is 1.6. How far should decentralization go? And especially with an epidemic that's fueled by IDUs. Mm-hmm. So that's, could you comment on that?
Yes, thank you for this question. We are already facing difficulties, infrastructural difficulties, because in the country we have only 35 AIDS centers. So further scale up is very difficult to continue just within the existing infrastructure. At the same time, as I mentioned, TB remains a major issue. Narcological clinics or drug treatment facilities, again, dealing with a number of HIV patients. So it's still an infrastructural challenge for us to accommodate all the services in specialized institutions. So we are planning to continue treatment, of course, through the AIDS centers, so at least this is a governmental structure, but at the same time to introduce ARV treatment or to create a special centers for treatment of the patients with these three problems, HIV, TB, and drug use. From the other side, pilots we conducted in one of the regions demonstrated its success. So some even general medical facilities after the appropriate training of the human resources are able to maintain quality treatment and monitoring of the patients. Another reason for this is easy access. Ukraine is relatively big, geographically big country, size of France. So it's easy access for the patients if treatment will be decentralized as well.
My name is Françoise Jenneskens from the Royal Tropical Institute in Amsterdam. I would like to understand a little bit better the population that you have on among in treatment now. What is the proportion of IDUs as compared to general population? It seems that your scale-up is a little bit slower than we see in the African countries, but on the other hand, your adherence seems to be, and your people that you still have on treatment, much higher. While if you have an IDU population, I would think that would be a very difficult population to keep on treatment. So I would like a little bit more explanation of what specifics you have done and whether this is because you are an NGO that you have a better entry to reaching these hard to reach populations, and if it is a good strategy to hand over the IDU population as well to the government or only your other population. It's a bit long question, but
Yes, I will start with the coverage. The situation is the following, as I mentioned, that according to the governmentally registered system, only 131,000 cases were of HIV were registered, and more than 30,000 of this of people passed away already. So, in reality, medical system dealing with not estimated number of patients, but with real patients registered in the medical system. And if we take this figure, which is about 80,000 HIV positive people who are stay alive, so more than 10% are on treatment, which is a reasonable proportion. So in terms of the coverage, it's more or less reasonable in this situation. In regard to the reaching drug user population, it's still the problem, and according to the code of all HIV positive people are registered, majority of people on treatment received HIV through injecting drug use. So it's still the biggest group on ARV treatment. At the same time, we understand that most of the hidden population, most of the populations who are not registered in AIDS center are injecting drug users. So our recent interventions demonstrated that availability of substitution treatment with methadone is actually gives access for injecting drug users to be positive drug users to be on treatment as well. So that's why we consider this linkage as crucially important for further scale up of ARV treatment in Ukraine.
Okay, thank you. Next question.
My name is Zahid Islam, International HIV AIDS Alliance, Ukraine. Actually, this is not a question, just two comments. First comment is on the first comments on follow up with what Andre is saying about retaining 89% of patients on treatment. It is because of NGOs together with the AIDS Center has been working in the field. So therefore, they had number of collaboration between the NGOs and the healthcare institution. Due to that, they could follow up the patients together with the NGOs. So that's why it's the high number of retention rate in the treatment. And second one is about the previous question on... I just forgot, sorry. So, anyway, thank you.
Final contribution or comment or question?
Actually, this is the comment and the general comment for all the speakers. My name is Naoko Ishikawa from International Medical Center of Japan, and we are working in Zambia to bring the ALT service down to health center through JICA project. And I try to make the comment that the questions that we really need to answer now is, are we really ready for the second wave of scale up? Because now the PITC is launched, we are expecting more and more people who need ARV.
and but actually the existing ART sites such as the central hospital, regional hospital or district hospital is already overwhelmed and they can't really accommodate more patients. So I think it is the time to bring the service to the health centers. But this is very challenging. And also, I think that some of our colleagues said that the strengthening the public sector, the health system is very, very important. So the question, another thing that we need to ask as a donor is that are we really strengthening the public sector of that country? Are we really supporting their government system, health system or not? And just, I try to give some example of our project in Zambia. We make the one team of the physicians or nurse or sometimes the lab technician, which we call that ART support team, who goes to the selected health center like every 2 weeks, and then they help the health center staff to provide care and treatment. And then so after the healthcare centers, that they start to be able to run the clinic by themselves, we withdraw and we move to another health centers. But also we found that this is quite challenging. So as a conclusion, what I want to point out is that the second wave of scaling up is a really tough one and really we need to be ready for it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that intervention. I would just point out that if we look at the global figures for treatment scale up, in the year 2006, there were about 800,000 people who newly started ART. In 2007, we saw just under 1 million, 980,000 people newly starting ART. So globally, there is no evidence that there's a slowing down of the numbers of people entering treatment programs, and indeed the pace of entering programs appears to be continuing to accelerate. So I think it's a concern that we won't be able to sustain and deliver on the second wave, but we don't have any figures, any evidence of that at the global level. I'd like to thank all our three speakers. First of all, a round of applause to André. And then I'd like to wrap up this session and again thank Ian for suggesting it and making it happen. We've had three absolutely excellent and really quite inspiring presentations representing three very different ways in which scale-up has been achieved in countries and some very interesting discussions of what the issues are for looking towards universal access. The first from Peter was with a PEPFAR-funded program that he's involved with in Uganda that really drove the national Ugandan ART program forward. The second from Malawi was from a global fund program, which had the government as the principal recipient. And then the third from a different epidemic, entirely from the generalized epidemic in Africa, from the Ukraine, which had a global fund resourced program, but that was managed by an NGO rather than government. I think you'll all be able to reflect on some of the similarities of the challenges that have been discussed and presented, and I'd like to thank everybody in the audience for the points, comments and questions that they've made, and also that we need to reflect on some of the specific challenges that are quite context specific, either to the country or the type of the epidemic that they have, or indeed some of the funding mechanisms and the challenges that they present themselves. So I'd like to, if we could all thank once again the speakers, and I'd like also to thank the audience for this excellent session.